today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Jim, I'm afraid I have some bad news about the podcast.
Well, whatever it is, Patrick, I'm sure we can work through it.
Well, I hope so. You see, I actually forgot that before Rockin' the Suburbs started, I signed a contract with another podcasting company. So we're going to have to go back through all of our episodes and replace my voice. Jim? Jim? Jim!
All right, Patrick, this is super exciting today because yes, I feel like we have finally caught our white whale. And that is listener and patron Bill Mulligan, who has been a patron for a long time at the level where he gets to come on the show and pick the topic, but he hasn't not done it. Like we have, he's banked up I don't know, 20, 30, 35 episodes at this point, something like that. So we finally have him, and we're going to record with Bill today and tomorrow here on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And before all that, I just want to get this going.
Nice.
But we're recording late enough today I can do this. Ooh. We've been recording a lot more in mornings and midday a lot, so you don't hear us with the crack of the beer can. But today's a little bit later. This is courtesy of Trip Bacon. This is the Bowie Czech-style Pilsner. So I'm going to try
Czech-style Pilsner.
Out of Oregon, right? So, okay,
That's a tasty brew.
Welcome to the show, Bill Mulligan. Hello, Bill.
Thank you. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
So. Yeah, absolutely. It's great to have you, Bill. And I'll say this, Bill has always been a sign for me that the podcast is going in the right direction because someone from my own town was listening and I was so happy about that. And Bill, who we've met, you know, in person and hung out with and really gotten to know, is just an amazing guy and so glad to have you. And I'll never forget, we met Bill the night of a live event at Greg Wilson's house when we had a big party, and it was really awesome to meet him. I was so excited, and he's such a great part of our Friday night hootenannies as well.
Yeah, that was fun back in the days when we could actually
get together,
talk to people and shake their hands. And
which is the other thing about this. If, you know, once this is all behind us, when we have patrons of the show come on and they're local, we like to get together, and as opposed to this over the Zoom business that we're doing now. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, that's actually why I signed up to be a patron, was to force you two to hang out with me one night every quarter. So
I love it. So, well, hopefully it won't be too far away.
Before we get into the topic today, Bill, do you want to introduce yourself a little bit to the audience? Like, we already mentioned you live in Falls Church, Virginia, but like, what do you do and how did you, you know, get into music and so on?
What I do, I'm an attorney, so don't hold that against me.
No, we need that.
I got into music. My parents, my father especially, was big into music. And my parents were very young when I was born. My father was 23, my mother was 20. So there was still like top 40 music on in the house when I was in maybe my preteens and whatnot. My father was more of a bluegrass fan, but the point is there was always music in the house. None of us was able to perform it very well, but we sort of liked listening to it.
Very cool.
Did you grow up in this part of the country?
My father was a naval officer. So we lived in California from when I can remember until I was 14, and then we moved to Northern Virginia when I was 14, and I've been here now for over four decades. So.
Wow. Very cool. You know, interestingly enough, the Washington, D.C. area, Jim, this is something I think we may have touched on in a cursory way, but it has a very, very strong bluegrass and country music tradition. D.C., especially with the Birchmere and a lot of the folks that booked that music and, you know, going way back to, you know, the 50s. It's really interesting. So the bluegrass thing makes a lot of sense. There used to be, and I'm sure you remember this, Bill, on WAMU, our local NPR station, used to play bluegrass music every afternoon from like 3 to 5, right? It was great. Yeah. Bluegrass country with Bill Davis. Not Bill Davis. I'm saying his name wrong. But it's a guy who used to do that show. It was great. I loved it. And I'll tell you one quick story. We really wanted to get my friend Brad's name on the radio. And so we wanted to record it for this certain purpose, but we wanted this one DJ who did bluegrass to say it. So during the pledge drive, we called up and donated some money so he would announce Brad's name. And we recorded it in two different places, me and Andy, just to make sure we got it. But it was great to have this guy, you know, with a deep baritone saying, Brad Mailer from Fairfax, Virginia.
Yeah, I remember my father listening to the bluegrass show on WAMU. And the first time I was at the Birchmere, which is one of our premier local music hall, was when my father took the family down to a bluegrass show. I can't remember who it was, but but yeah.
That's cool. The first concert my middle offspring MJ ever went to was a Ralph Stanley concert at the Birchmere. So,
Wow.
Yeah. Nice. She fell asleep.
And I'm starting at the top there.
Yeah. I wanted her to see him before he left this realm, and we were lucky enough to do that.
Yeah. I did that once with my kids. We went to see Tony Bennett at Wolf Trap.
Yes.
And my two kids were the two youngest people in the audience. And my wife and I think, were the third and fourth youngest people in the audience. But man, this was like a week before his, maybe the day before his 90th birthday.
Wow.
And he can still sing.
Wow. Yeah. That is so cool.
That's great. All right. So what do we want to talk about as the official topic today?
So this is actually about another person who was making music back in the 50s and 60s, although Tony Bennett's kept it up. Lee Hazlewood. Are either of you very familiar with Lee Hazlewood?
Yeah, I am in like a spotty way. What I know mainly is his involvement with Gram Parsons and kind of signing him and the, what is it, International Submarine Band? To their first record contract, later of which caused some problems for the Birds. But
I was going to mention that.
Yeah. But yeah, that's where mainly I know him from, and writing, you know, a couple songs here and there. And I'll tell you later, I'm reading a book that I just came across his name, weirdly enough, the other day. So, yeah.
So, yeah, without reading his Wikipedia to you, he was born in 1929 in Oklahoma. His father was an oilman, and they moved around the South. And like me, he didn't seem to be a history of musical performing in the family, but he got into it, was a drummer in the Army. And then after he got out of the, and a DJ in the Army as well. After he got out of the Army, he moved to Coolidge, Arizona, which is like halfway between Phoenix and Tucson, and was DJing there. He, I guess, at this time, from things I've read, he was learning what, not only what he liked, but what worked. You know, because this is the early days of rock and roll.
Right.
He's learning what worked on the radio and the sounds that worked. There was a local kid, a 16-year-old, in Coolidge, who would come by the radio station to ask if they were getting rid of any records. Because he wanted to build his record collection on the cheap.
Yep.
This kid was Duane Eddy.
Yeah.
And so Hazlewood and Eddy got to be friends. And Hazlewood started producing Eddy. And in fact, he produced Duane Eddy's first album. Eddy's first hit, which was Movin' and Groovin', Hazlewood wrote it. And Hazlewood is the songwriter, which for an instrumental sounds a little weird, but Hazlewood is a songwriter for Rebel Rouser. So
got it, right.
His first big hit was, I forget what Rebel Rouser went up to, like number six or something. I mean, it was one of the biggest songs in the country at the time. Sometimes to find out what happened with these old guys back in the day. We're so used to thinking everything, all the information is available.
Right.
I found a couple of different stories. Like I said, Hazlewood knew the sounds that he wanted and was trying to figure out how to make them. And some things seem to imply that he invented reverb, but even if he came up with an idea, I'm sure lots of other people came up with it independently at the same time. But there was a story that Duane Eddy tells of him and Hazlewood and the owner of the studio driving around to junkyards in Phoenix looking for old water tanks and walking around the junkyard, yelling into the end of water tanks and seeing what the echo sounded like.
Wow.
And then they found one they liked. They paid the guy $200 for it and they shipped it to the studio. It wouldn't fit in the studio, so they had to record in the parking lot. And they basically put Eddie's amplifier at one end of it and the microphone at the other. And that was how he got Duane Eddy's rich, resonant sound was in an old water tank that they purchased.
That's wild.
That's
man.
So great.
I have never heard that story before. That's incredible. And, yeah. And now it's just a little turn of a knob.
Well, right. Now it's all done
on a guitar amplifier. Yeah.
Through technology, people have figured out ways to do this. But back then it was organic. Yeah.
Yeah. You wonder sometimes, too, how now that it's so, I say it's so easy, I can't do it. But for performers, some things are so easy. I don't know if that makes a difference to the music when you have to go through a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, frequently literal blood, sweat, and tears, to create an effect just 30 years ago, much less 60 years ago. And now, like you said, you just push a button or turn a dial.
Right.
It's crazy. Bill, I just bought, this is not a joke, for $120, I bought this Casio keyboard that has 400 tones on it and 100 rhythms and ability to like have loop effects. And there's tons of like reverb settings, and you can make it sound like a concert hall. You can make it sound like a stadium. It's unbelievable. It was $120, right? So a lot less than going out and getting a tank, a water tank.
Yeah.
You know, and having it shipped.
Yeah, they spent $80 more that's than right. you. And that's they, right. That's right. They only got one effect.
That's right.
But, you know, one thing I'll say too, Bill, I think about this a lot, especially because I inevitably end up, it seems like once a month, I'm somehow on the John Peel site looking at something or wondering about something. But you mentioned Hazelwood was a DJ. I think it's really interesting when people who become producers start out as a DJ, because like you said, it's about finding what works, and you get to go through so many records and you have all these opportunities, I'm sure, even back then, to listen to free records, right? Or people were plugging their songs and all this. And I think it's so interesting. And I always think like, gosh, John Peel would have been a great producer, but maybe not, right? You have to have a certain element of your personality that also lends itself to being a producer, right? You know, you almost have to be like a psychologist in some ways to know when to press someone or know when to coax it out of them. You know what I mean? And I don't know. I just think it's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then at some point in the 50s, Hazelwood, I guess the success he'd had with Eddie. Incidentally, one of the things I found researching this is that both Hazelwood and Dwayne are not spelled the way I expected them to be spelled. I was constantly misspelling Hazelwood. The L comes before the E, not afterward, which is maybe that's correct. And apparently Dwayne, Eddie spelled his name D-U-A-N-E. No W's involved.
But, that's weird. Yeah.
So his success with Eddie as a producer attracted the attention of bigger labels. He moved out to Los Angeles and was doing some production work out there. He also wanted to be a performer. Hmm. And in 1963, he released his first solo album, which was this Trouble is a Lonesome Town. We would call it, a concept album.
Yeah.
It was about the colorful residents of a little town called Trouble. I don't think we were told where Trouble is. Like 200 people live in this town.
Yeah.
And every single one of them is crazy and eccentric and colorful. I don't think it's a very good record. certainly 60 years later, it sounds very hokey. Maybe it was.
Yeah.
Maybe it wasn't as cornponed in 1963 as it is now. It wasn't a success. And in fact, he released four albums over a 3 or 4 year period, and he had no chart success with any of them. But some songs on his later works were picked up by other artists. And in fact, Dean Martin had a hit with Houston.
Yep.
Which was another Hazelwood.
Well, it's lonesome in this old town. Everybody puts me down. I'm a face without a name, just walking in the rain, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. I got holes in both of my shoes while I'm a walking case of the blues. Saw a dollar yesterday, but the wind blew it away. Going back to Houston, Houston, Houston.
And I'll tell you, Bill, that's the book I'm actually reading right now. I'm reading a biography of Dean Martin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Written by Nick Toches, or Toches, kind of a well-known Rolling Stone writer, and he wrote some books on his own. And apparently it was this book he wrote, I don't know, at some point, you know, because he had a contract and had money, and it he did a fantastic job. It's such an interesting story. I learned all about Jim, this is a topic for another time, the underworld side of Ohio. There was a lot of gambling and saloons and stuff in Ohio, Steubenville, specifically where Dean Martin came from. So, but yeah, this is where I came across Lee Hazelwood's name. Very interesting.
Oh, wow. And the connection with Dean Martin was then, so like I said, in addition to his unsuccessful work as a performer, he was mm-hmm. still producing. And he ended up producing a band called, let me see here, get it right, Dino, Desi, and Billy.
Right.
Dino being Dino Martin,
yep.
the son of Dean Martin. Desi being Desi Arnaz Jr.
Yeah.
And Billy being somebody who was described as Billy Thatcher, their friend.
their running buddy, yeah.
Yeah, they apparently were the 1965 boy band.
Mm,
they had a hit, again, with a Lee Hazelwood song. What was it called? Not the Love and Kind, hit number 25. They were all like 15 years old when this happened.
I'm not the loving kind, so you better get it off your mind. Give you money, I don't care. Take you with me anywhere. I'll tell you, baby, I'm not the loving kind.
They kind of faded. They were savaged by the critics, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that at this point, he got noticed, I guess because of his association with the Martin family,
mm-hmm.
by the Sinatras.
Ah.
So, as you mentioned before, you knew about his work with Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, record producers who wanted, I guess, with Sinatra behind them, they wanted Hazelwood to produce Nancy Sinatra.
Ah.
And at this point, she had had a career that started in the early 60s and mm-hmm. had like a dozen non-album singles, none of which charted. Her career mm-hmm. was not going anywhere. And I think this is 65 at this point. So Hazelwood is asked by this neighbor of his if he'll produce Sinatra, Nancy. And mm-hmm. he says, no, I've had enough of the children of actual stars.
Right.
I don't want to be involved in any more of that. So his neighbor says, well, just come and meet her. So...
Or you're going to end up in the river with cement shoes.
Well, yeah. So he didn't say that, but so there's, although there's an aspect to that. So he goes to this party, which he thinks is just a small group so that he can meet Nancy Sinatra.
Okay.
And he gets there, and there are a lot of heavy hitters at this party.
Mm.
People like Bobby Darin.
Yeah.
Everybody apparently was drinking Chivas Regal, which was Lee Hazelwood's coif of choice.
Ah.
And so he's thinking something's up. And then halfway through the party, Frank Sinatra walks into the room, walks up to him, shakes his hand, and says, thank you for agreeing to be Nancy's producer. Now, whether it was just his magnetism and his magnitude, or whether there was some fear of underground entanglements, I don't know. But Hazelwood did not think that he could say no to Frank Sinatra in 1965.
Probably a good choice.
So that's how he ended up as Nancy Sinatra's producer.
That's great.
So, of course, her first album, which was entitled Boots, and contains the Lee Hazelwood penned song, These Boots Were Made for Walking.
There you go.
Which, you know, became like number one in every country.
Right. Huge
around
hit.
The globe.
Huge hit.
Yeah.
Still known today by everyone, virtually, right?
Oh, yeah. Like,
who doesn't know that song?
Yeah. So prior to this, in addition to being unsuccessful, I guess she was trying to project a very wholesome image.
Hmm.
And one of the things that Hazelwood said to her, I honestly don't know that I can repeat the quote or that you can put out the quote of the direction that he gave her. But let's just say that he told her that she should take a more lascivious approach to the material, that Goody Goody wasn't working for her, and she needed to try something else. And she did it, and it worked.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they were off and running. And between 66, I guess that was 66 and 68, they did 7 albums together where he produced and he wrote most of the material on these 7 albums. And those 7 albums had 8 top 40 singles, including three that were in the top 10.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't think people today realize, I mean, like I said, everybody knows These Boots Are Made for Walking. Like, it's a hugely popular song and very well-known song. One thing I think it's lost with Nancy Sinatra is how big of a star she was for that mm-hmm. period of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was huge. She had hit after hit after hit. And like you're saying, thanks to Lee Hazelwood, I guess.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And at some point in here, they did a few songs together. And in fact, the only chart success that Hazelwood had as a performer was his duets with Nancy. They were Jackson, which I think a lot of people know the Johnny and June Cash version of. Yep. Although, interestingly, I found out when I was looking into this, the first version of that was done by the Kingston Trio.
Really?
I never knew that.
Yeah, first of all, you've got the problem of how do you have this back and forth between a man and a woman in a group that consists of three men?
Right.
They also, Nancy and Lee, not the Kingston Trio, also did Summer Wine, Lady Bird, and Some Velvet Morning.
Some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm gonna open up your gate and maybe tell you about Phaedra and how she gave me life and how she made it in. Some velvet morning when I'm straight.
Flowers growing on a hill, dragonflies and daffodils learn from us very much. Look at us, but do not touch. Phaedra is my
Now, Some Velvet Morning is why we are here. Sometime, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, late one night, I was poking around on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what I was looking for. I think I was looking for like psychedelic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Music, not...
yeah.
Not psychedelics. Not mescaline.
Yeah. Yeah. And I came across this. Are you familiar with this song?
I am.
No.
It is, and I mean this in the best possible way, it is bizarre. First of all, I saw the video, which I guess was from one of her TV specials. This was back in the day when there were still variety shows, but she had several, I guess, big one-night-only television specials.
Hmm.
And it was an early music video that they did for this song. The song is not a traditional duet. They're never singing at the same time, so they're certainly not harmonizing.
Right.
It's like two separate songs that were edited together, interwoven. Oh, the other thing, too, is the back and forth between the man and the woman. Like, the man's portion is in 4/4 time, and the woman's in 3/4 time. I mean, it really comes across as two completely independent songs that have been edited together by somebody. But Hazelwood, in the studio, said to the classically trained musicians, we'll just record the 4/4 part straight through, and then we'll record the 3/4 part straight through, and I'll put them together in the studio. And apparently they were highly insulted that this guy thought that they, classical musicians, weren't capable of handling a time signature change.
Right.
And they did it one through. So yeah, it's just a really weird song. One critic, let me get this right, described it as an outlaw country western singer drowning in a pool of reverb, constantly interrupted by a dazed hippie, and the whole thing is haunted by a storm cloud of an orchestra. I've listened to it dozens, maybe hundreds of times, and I couldn't tell you what it's about. It's probably about sex and or drugs, although, of course, all of pop music is about sex and or drugs. One line, if I may, some velvet morning when I'm straight, I'm going to open up your gate. Trippy. You know, I said before I was looking for psychedelics. You don't need the other kind of psychedelics to listen to this song because it is really a bizarre experience. In a very good way. I mean, I really love it, but it is It is an odd song.
It really is one of kind of the most interesting songs in pop music history, in my opinion, Bill. And you described it really perfectly. And I think I just love that. Like, that's the perfect way to find that song is late at night poking around on YouTube, right? Because you're open to anything kind of at that point. And I'll tell you where I first heard it was, and this is weird to me now that, you know, hearing some of that backstory, which I didn't know, but I heard a cover of it first on an album by Lydia Lunch. And I don't know if you guys know Lydia Lunch, sort of the poetic New York punk queen, kind of a cross between a, you know, like a sort of a goth look and like a Marilyn Monroe look. And she was in a band called Eight Eyed Spy, and she was pretty important on the no wave early 70s scene. And Roland S. Howard, who was the guitar player in one of my all-time favorite bands, The Birthday Party, which was Nick Cave's first band, they did a collaboration on this on an album they made together. I looked it up. It's called Honeymoon in Red. They even issued it as a single, and it somehow made the charts in Australia, apparently. So, and now, as you look here, there's been a ton of covers.
Really?
Of it since then, yeah. I'm just looking. I didn't even realize how many have been made since. That one was made in 82, so it was an early one. Oh, although apparently Vanilla Fudge covered it in 69. That's weird enough. But then a whole bunch of people have covered it from the mid-80s on. So
I'm not a musician, but it would seem to me the only thing crazier than making that song in the first place is trying to cover it.
Yeah. Totally.
So anyways, that song, like a lot of the stuff that he had for her, you know, again, he had told her to emphasize her feminine allure. A lot of the stuff he wrote for her, there was a lot of double entendre going on there. You know, some of it about sex, some of it not. Like, apparently Sugartown, he wrote that for her after seeing people in a club doing LSD on a sugar cube. So he wrote Sugartown. And Summer Wine, another one of her songs. I think that was a duet. I'm not sure what's going on, but I know there was carnality involved in it. So, and yet, this was the kind of stuff that was making it to top 40 in the late 60s when you had to hide it, which, you know, in some ways, as an old person, I think that's, I kind of like that. Make it harder for the audience to get what you're saying. Make them do a little work.
That's right.
He's just so base and obvious about things.
Yeah. It has a certain charm to it, I think.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things.
I walked in town on silver spurs that jingled too. A song that I had only sang to just a few. She saw my silver spurs and said, let's pass some time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
So they only worked together for 2 or 3 years, and by 68, they were done as a group. And in fact, she never hit the top 40 again. She had a few songs that barely made it above 100, but she never hit the top 40 again, and he didn't. He did try to capture lightning in a bottle in 1969 by recording an album with Ann Margaret, which I guess wasn't well received, although I suspect that in 1969, just about any man would have taken the opportunity to spend several hours, if not several days, in the same room as Ann Margaret.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
So maybe he wasn't trying for a musical success there. Earlier, you mentioned Gram Parsons. And yeah, just to flesh that story out, Hazelwood had his own label, LHI, Lee Hazelwood Industries.
Yep.
Or maybe International, one of those two. And they never did put out anything that was a big success, but they did sign the International Submarine Band, which was fronted by Gram Parsons. They recorded Safe at Home, but before they released Safe at Home, Parsons quit.
That's right.
To join the Byrds.
Yes.
Hazelwood, from what I can tell, was kind of an iconoclast. He was kind of a grump.
Yeah.
And he got really angry because he thought basically that Gram Parsons is the International Submarine Band.
Right.
So now I'm left trying to promote an album by a band that doesn't even exist anymore.
Right.
So when Parsons joined the Byrds, recorded Sweetheart of the Rodeo with them, Hazelwood sued because he said he's still under contract to LHI. Part of the settlement, it's difficult to find, you know, 60-year-old court documents on the internet.
But I love that we have you as an attorney to sort this out. This is great. Okay, go on.
But part of the settlement was that they basically had to remove almost all of Parsons' vocals.
That's right.
From Sweetheart of the Rodeo and have McGuinn re-record them.
Right.
And from what I've read, that was part of the reason that Parsons quit
the Birds.
The Birds.
That's right. Yeah.
Picked the Birds and formed the Flying Burrito Brothers.
Yeah.
So even for acts that he wasn't involved with, Hazelwood was kind of changing the course of late 60s country rock there by suing people instead of producing them.
It's totally an amazing story. And think about, and I'll just speak from my own perspective, how much I love Sweetheart of the Rodeo.
Right.
Like how I've listened to it so many times. You know all the nuances of the songs, you know, and I think now you can go back and find the Gram Parsons vocals, right? And, you know, Roger McGuinn did base, you know, a lot of the way that singing went on what Gram Parsons had done. But still, I mean, I much prefer the Roger McGuinn versions than to what was originally, you know, going to be the record. And I think that's so interesting to me. And I'll tell you how I know this too, folks. If you haven't and you want to read a great book on Gram Parsons, go back to the original really good biography written by Ben Fong Torres. Yes, portrayed in Almost Famous as the guy who gives William Miller his break. But go back and read Hickory Wind. It details this whole really interesting story that Bill's touching on and how Graham came from Florida and got involved with all this and got to L.A. And a lot had to do with Lee Hazelwood. So that's basically was my main information on him. That's what I thought of, when you think of him in rock and roll history.
So then by about 1970, from what I can tell, he had kind of pissed off a lot of people in Hollywood. And there were vague references to tax problems. And he had a teenage son whom he did not want to get drafted. So in 1970, Hazelwood moved to Stockholm, Sweden. he just kind of disappeared, both literally and figuratively, from the United States. And he continued to record in the 70s, but most of this stuff wasn't released in the United States. Hmm. Basically, his career in the United States ended when his collaboration with Nancy Sinatra ended.
Yeah.
And he lived in Europe for a long time. Now, kind of like they did with Rockabilly, the Europeans, though, kept interest in Hazelwood alive. And he was actually fairly popular, from what I can tell, in Europe. So that's kind of the end of the Lee Hazelwood story. The one thing is he did release an album in 1971 called Requiem for an Almost Lady. And some people say that's his best album. He says it wasn't about any woman in specific. It was just about his loves lost over his lifetime. I listened to it for the first time the other day when I was working on this. And one thing about him, I didn't even mention this before, Hazelwood had the most amazing baritone voice. I mean, the man himself sounded like he was in like an echo chamber. I mean, he was really amazing. And whereas a lot of his stuff from the 60s, especially that first album, was kind of hokey, this is very stripped down, just him and his voice and his guitar and maybe occasionally a bass. And it's really a beautiful album. I definitely plan on listening to it a lot more.
And one day I'll turn around and she'll be standing there. And I'll wonder how she'll look, how she'll act, and what she'll say. I know what I'll say. And I think I'll write a song about it someday. Love's a game, and it's a shame, but sometimes you don't win. But don't you do what others do when I see you again. 'Cause I'd rather be your enemy than hear you call me friend. Yes, I'd rather be your enemy than hear you call me friend.
And he died, 2007. He made it back to Henderson, Nevada, and passed away there. But that's not the end of the Lee Hazelwood story.
Okay.
So in 2018, somewhere in the vaults, sometime prior to 2018, somebody found a complete album of surf music that Hazelwood had recorded. From what they could tell in the notes, it was recorded in October of 1964, and they released it under the name Lee Hazelwood's Woodchucks. Apparently, this is kind of like the story with Reverb. This may be one of those stories where a lot of people claim that they were responsible for something.
Right.
I saw a few implications that Hazelwood had brought together people who then went on to become the Wrecking Crew.
Interesting.
Al Casey, when Hazelwood was in Arizona, he also did work with producing Al Casey, who I guess later became one of the guitar players in the Wrecking Crew. And from what people can tell, Hal Blaine drummed on this Cruisin' for Surf Bunnies is the title of the album. And most of the songs on it were written by Hazelwood. The album itself was stuck in a vault and didn't see the light of day for 50 plus years. But several of the songs, I don't know how up on your surf music are, but Baja by the Astronauts, one of the kind of classic or seminal surf music tunes, another Hazelwood composition.
Wow, interesting.
And Dick Dale, The Ventures, The Safaris all did covers of songs that were on Cruisin' for Surf Bunnies. So, I mean, it's not quite the fine work that Jimi Hendrix is still putting out, but even a decade after Hazelwood passed away, was releasing music. So,
well, and that's an interesting point, Bill, too. You know, as we were talking, I've been perusing a little bit here on Discogs, and it's incredible. As someone who goes on Discogs a lot, and as everyone knows who listens to this podcast, I'm a record collector, but his records have gained value, especially the original editions. And also there's been some reissues. There's actually been a cover project that I did not know about that Black Francis from the Pixies was involved with, and a couple tribute albums. So it's very interesting to me, and I don't know what your thoughts are, but that his work has gained esteem as the years have gone by, not only because he made a lot of these landmark and in some cases like Some Velvet Morning, like just totally original pieces of music, but people were interested in everything he was doing and, you know, all across the spectrum. And it's such an interesting topic. I'm so glad that you brought this up. And I just find it fascinating. To me, he kind of fits in this weird little category in my mind, which we all know is a scary enough place, but with Jimmy Webb, he's kind of over there with Jimmy Webb with like these two guys that had this influence and did all these amazing things. And yet you're like, I don't really know that much about them at all. So it's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hazelwood was definitely, I guess, I don't know, you'd say a musician's musician.
Yeah.
I think the general public, maybe even a lot of people who listen to the podcast who probably don't qualify as the general public, probably a little more knowledgeable than your average Joe, but a lot of people probably wouldn't, you know, completely blank if you say the name Hazelwood. And yet, I was seeing reference to people like Nick Cave and just all these musicians throughout the last 30 years who cite him as an inspiration. Or it is amazing that somebody like that could be so influential and yet.
Yeah, he's an obscure figure for sure.
Yeah.
And a bit of a cult figure, like you said. So he definitely had an impact, but you got to be sort of in the know to understand pretty much anything about Lee Hazelwood. It's not like he's a top of mind figure at all.
Yeah.
And it's so fascinating to learn all this. It really is.
I know.
Yeah. I'm certainly glad I was poking around YouTube that night.
There you go. Me too. And that's what it did. And that led you down the Lee Hazelwood rabbit hole, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. So I heartily recommend Lee Hazelwood to everybody.
Very cool. And I also love that it's a story with so many twists and turns, like, you know, so you can really go and investigate all the little, you know, ins and outs and different things and all the ways his influence touched people. So cool.
It feels like this could be a movie starring John C. Reilly or something like that, right?
Yeah. I was just thinking that exact same thing. It's the kind of thing that I'd like to see a movie of. I don't know if anybody, the general public would, but I definitely.
Yeah.
Sounds so cool. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Bill. This has been fabulous. Awesome. What a great idea.
Yeah, thank you.
It took you like, a year to think about it?
More than that. Okay. I think that's okay. 16 months.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's great. We're glad it worked out. So, okay. So you're going to be with us again tomorrow, right?
Definitely. I've already got it in my calendar.
All right. Sweet.
So let's do that. If anybody would like to comment on Lee Hazelwood, if anybody out there is a fan or has anything else to add to this, we would love to hear it. So there are some ways you can contact us. One way is to call and leave a message on the voicemail. The number is 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can email rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. All those at suburbspod. All right. Let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs.
Cool.
I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Bill Mulligan.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. We'll talk to you, Bill, and everyone else tomorrow.
Yep, we both live here in this lovely leafy suburb of Washington, D.C.